This is another interesting session coming up. Its title is A Fairer World, and we have three speakers. I think I'm going to change slightly from the way Oliver did it and introduce each of them as they come up. So first of all, I'll introduce Natasha Wirt, who is a campaigner and peace activist and a Nichiren Buddhist. I hope I've pronounced that right. She will talk on How to Save the World, a Buddhist's Guide.
Great, okay, thank you. Firstly, I'm Natasha. I'm really, really, really pleased to be here. It's a real honor to speak to so many amazing people. And I'm here sharing something that I love. So I really hope that you'll enjoy it. It's a little bit different to the previous session. I'm a Nichiren Buddhist and I practice within SGI UK. And as my introduction said, I'm a peace activist as well. So I've only got a few minutes, so I've really taken I've really selected very, very carefully things which I think that will be interesting to you. I could talk for days about Buddhism. There's a lot of theory, so I've tried to keep it quite light and relevant to activism. Okay. So, what's the philosophy of UK culture? Suggestions, you know, freedom of choice, do what you want, live how you like, or entitlement, you know, entitlement to have things, to compete with people, to defend what we have, consumerism maybe. I was thinking about this and I can think of some areas of our society in which it's definitely not a culture of respect. Respect for people, respect for women, respect for human rights. Even in UK society, very much. And I suggest, this is my opinion, it may be a culture of arrogance. And this is arrogance in the Buddhist sense. A little bit provocative word, but it's the definition of Buddhist arrogance is to think that one is superior to those inferior to oneself and that one's equal to one's equals. So arrogant people feel good about themselves only through affirming their superiority to others. Our sense of superiority is always relative to who we're compared with and never constant because of our own changing circumstances. So false confidence based on this superiority easily turns into a feeling of inferiority and self-disparagement, which is very British, like a millionaire feeling poor among billionaires, or a PhD feeling foolish among Nobel laureates, or a healthy person feeling overweight among supermodels. This is why false humility or self-disparagement is also considered arrogance in Buddhism. Put another way, arrogance and self-disparagement are two sides of the same coin. So genuinely confident people feel great about themselves without comparing themselves to others. Okay, so a little bit about Nichiren Buddhism. This is quite different to what you'd stereotypically imagine when you think of Buddhism, probably. So Nichiren was a Buddhist monk, 13th century Japan, and he vowed to become the wisest person in Japan to stop people suffering, because at that time they had famine, they had war, they had all sorts of horrendous social situation. And he believed that in order to change this, Japan needed to have a philosophy to live by, which would establish the peace of the land. So just about Nichiren, he was persecuted all his life, he was exiled, he was almost beheaded, all sorts of things, but he was really joyful and he really shows how to be happy no matter what the circumstances, through this deep appreciation for and respect for life. And respect for life, you know, I used to think before I was Buddhist, you know, that Buddhists, they don't kill an ant and they don't eat meat and so on. But it's a lot more than this. It's actually a real developing this reverence for life and real, like, wow, appreciation, you know. Just to be around amazing human beings and to be, you know, alive in a body right now. So, and Buddhahood is this state of life where you feel this joy despite all of the circumstances. So it's a bit of a jargon word, Buddhahood, but basically it means unlimited courage, compassion, and wisdom, and that energy to transform any situation into benefit. So you can imagine that when you're feeling like this, no matter what horrendous circumstances you have, you can think, wow, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to transform my life and really create value. And that's the philosophy of Nichiren Buddhism. So there's a quote, a beautiful quote from Nietzsche in himself, which is, "Life is the foremost of all treasures. It's expounded that even the treasures of the entire major word system cannot equal the value of one's body and life. Even the treasures that fill the major world system are no substitute for life." I think it's really easy to forget this in normal life. It's actually a real practice to remind ourselves, like, wow, I'm so lucky, and this is an amazing place to be, even if it's really challenging. And there's this story of Bodhisattva Never Disparaging in the Lotus Sutra, which is the kind of the main teaching that we practice in Nichiren Buddhism. And it's this, a Bodhisattva is a person who's dedicated to transform the world, to really help people. So we can all be Bodhisattvas. And this Bodhisattva Never Disparaging, he used to go to people and he would constantly bow to them and say, "I deeply respect your life. I deeply respect your life." And these people used to get annoyed and they'd throw things at him and they'd tell him to go away and they'd swear at him. And he'd just back off and, "I deeply respect your life." You know, and that's the kind of, you know, it's a parable, but it's really showing how to practice this spirit in life. But it's not about being a doormat, because we have to respect our lives as well. Okay, so the spirit of this is that all people are infinitely precious, infinitely noble, infinitely worthy of respect. That's me. But all of you are. All of us are. Donald Trump is. You know, everyone. And this is why we practice, is to really feel that in our lives and behave from that place. So this humanistic philosophy requires that in order to respect other people, we have to really respect our lives and vice versa, because it's an equal teaching. So if we can't believe this, then we say that we're ignorant of the true nature of our lives. So and this is the real challenge, is why we practice. And this is seen in Buddhism as the cause of all suffering. We don't remember this. We can't believe this. And it's actually the core of why we practice, because it's the hardest thing to believe, that we're amazing and, you know, we have all this potential. So this is the reason why there's so much unhappiness in society. People don't feel they are enough. They're constantly seeking things outside themselves and they have to compete with each other. And the goal of Buddhism is to stop human suffering. So in terms of this quote at the top here, Maiji sazenen igari o shujo tokunyu mujodo sokujo jiu bushin. This is something which we recite every morning, every evening when we do our daily practice. And it means basically, at all times I think to myself, how can I quickly help human beings become happy? And this is that's the end of the passage that we recite. You know, at all times I'm thinking this. This is a great spirit to live by, you know. So war, inequality, all the problems in our world, all the horrendous things which I'm campaigning against and I really want to change, you know, destruction of the environment, all of that, it's actually, if you really think about it, it all comes down to this this root cause. And I think a lot of campaigning, actually, which I love, it comes from this top-down approach, but it doesn't address this root cause. So the root cause here, just for example, war begins in the human mind or the human heart. It stems from a desire to conquer and to control, to have power over people. And that feeling comes from a sense that we're lacking something, isn't it? We need to prove something. We need to establish something. We need to, in order to be worth something, we have to suddenly, you know, compare ourselves to someone else. So it comes back to this definition of arrogance. So a violent person or a competitive, you know, person who wants to overcome other people, they really have a lot of deep sadness in their life because they can't actually realize that they don't need that, that they're enough as they are. And they've got so much value and so much potential in their lives. Okay, so in order to change this, we really need to change the culture that we're living in, which is establishing a culture of respect for the peace and for the dignity of life, for the value of life. And that means in our lives as well, which is the thing that's really challenging. So world peace, it actually starts with each of us. It starts with me. It starts with you. It starts with literally all of us looking inside of ourselves, because the feelings of anger, of competitiveness, of insecurity, all of these feelings that we experience, they're actually a micro version of war, of all of these horrendous things that we're doing in our planet. And this is why we practice this this day. We have a daily practice, is to help us kind of really transform that. And so here's it. Yeah, and this is a quote again from the Lotus Sutra. If you were to seize Mount Sumeru and fling it far off to the measureless Buddha lands, that would not be difficult. But to believe in this is truly difficult. So it's really, it shows the real nature of human beings, that we really doubt ourselves, and we really struggle to believe that, wow, I'm actually amazing and I actually have so much to give, and that's really important. Okay, so in order to change the choices that are being made in politics, we need to change our culture, and it needs to be a culture where people have hope and confidence that they can transform any situation. They don't need to exert power over others. And we need to foster young people, the future leaders, who are going to be taking this kind of culture forward. So with this approach, we're tackling not just the symptoms, but it's a really bottom-down approach. It's an in-out approach, the ultimate bottom-down approach, because it starts inside your life. And I agree, action is required at all levels of society. So you don't have to necessarily be campaigning, lobbying the government on issues if that's not what you're really passionate about. But you can be doing this, living this philosophy, by transforming your life and encouraging the people around you that they have so much value, so much worth, and that they can transform their lives and create value in them. So yeah, and we do this by having dialogue with people, by being the type of person that when you see someone upset on the train or whatever, you actually talk to them, you actually create that culture of peace, you know, so it's a really active practice. I think I've run out of time now. But yeah, here we are, I'll just finish with this quote. A great human revolution is in just a single individual will help achieve a change in the destiny of a nation, and further will enable a change in the destiny of all humankind. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha. Just a few years ago, The Guardian did a kind of not scientific or you know, a sort of survey of ethnicity and religion all over London, which they said wasn't definitive. But I noticed that in Lewisham, one of the major religions, perhaps the major religion, was Buddhism, which really surprised me, and I wondered which of my neighbours were Buddhist without me knowing it. Thank you very much, Natasha. That was very interesting and some thoughtful things there. I now call on Tasia. Tasia Kobylinska is a lecturer in media communications, lecturer in media and communications at Goldsmiths. And she's produced and directed documentaries and films on international policy and human rights. She's going to talk on film as social action.
I'm Tasia, and as was said, I lecture in film practice at Goldsmiths, and I make independent films as well. And I'm here to talk about the use of film as a spur to social action. And I was really happy when I walked in to see two of my students actually putting this into practice right now. So very well done for that. Okay, so this is a short 8-minute talk, and unusually for a talk about film, I'm not actually going to show you any clips because otherwise I can't blather on. So. What I'm going to do is at the end, I'm going to put some links for further information and guidance for watching films that have had a huge impact on the world or local level. And I think this is going to be available on the Open Democracy website, so you can find those links there. So, okay, well, film, it's undoubted and it's unarguable that film has a social impact, can have a social impact on the world. And certainly in this country, one of the most famous examples is Kathy Come Home in 1966, which pretty much launched shelter and crisis and created a national conversation about the condition of housing in this country. And a more recent example might be Making a Murderer. I don't know if anybody watched that on Netflix, which now kind of went viral on the internet as well and created a conversation about justice, class, and so on in America, and actually has reopened a case which was highly questionable about a murder charge for two working class men. There are lots and lots of examples of this. Okay, so why, first of all, I'd just like to have a look at why does film have an impact, or why does it spur us into change, action, and sort of long-term shifts in culture? It's very difficult because this is a huge area, but if I was going to boil it down, which I have done, I would say that it's because we love to be told stories. We love to see people like ourselves on screen, especially when it's about triumph over adversity. Film as a medium can have more direct impact or a more instantaneous impact than maybe reading an article about an issue in a magazine or on the newspaper, or I'm sure this could be debatable, but or hearing a radio audio-only documentary. And powerful stories can resonate with us on a very deep emotional level. So I have to keep looking because I'm not seeing my slides come up here. So we may feel a strong sense of anger and identification with the subject, and it may spur us into taking action, especially if the film has a call to action at the end, which is becoming more and more common, as we'll see shortly. Films can have an impact on many different levels. So it could be on a global level, for example, the use of social media to kind of to spread the message and get people engaged and active has become pretty much a part of most films' distribution campaigns. The types of change that can be affected by films that have a strong social message or a call to action, a call to arms, as it were. It could be a long-term change, a kind of shifting of awareness in society, a shifting in the way that we treat each other or perceive people that may have been misunderstood or living on the margins of society, that we kind of get familiarised with people other than ourselves. And kind of in the spirit of what Natasha was saying, that this affects a change in how we kind of treat each other and the respect that we give to others around us. It could affect an inspiration for direct action. For example, joining a political group or a local campaign, getting involved in neighbourhood politics or community action, going on demonstrations, or even just kind of raising awareness around people wherever you see them and speaking about the issue that you've seen. So these kind of things can have an impact on that level. National level changes is a very important film that was made about rape in the military. 500,000 women were suffering from no justice to rapes and sexual assaults in the military, which got taken up in a film called Invisible War. It went online, it went viral, it had its own hashtag, Invisible No More, and people contacted their local government representatives, and this ended up going all the way up to the Senate because of this kind of grassroots response to a film and the anger in the communities that and the people that watched it. And it actually ended up being a change in national legislation. So that's a huge impact that a film can have. So a film can affect a change at a governmental level, a global level. In 2002, a film called Find Kony, who was a warlord who, this film highlighted the exploitation of child soldiers in Africa. It kind of somehow sparked the imagination of very young watchers who took it up as a social media campaign, and this went global, and there were 21 million views on YouTube. So it kind of raised an awareness of those issues on a global level, although the film itself is quite controversial. At a corporate level, Morgan Spurlock's Supersize Me actually forced McDonald's to change their to withdraw their Supersize menu and relook at their nutrition. And at a societal level, I just want to give a plug to a colleague of mine, Sue Clayton, who is currently exhibiting a prelude to a film that she's making about child refugees in Calais, which is at the James Hatchett Building. I think it might end today, actually, but if you get a chance, that's very, Laurie Grove in next door to Goldsmiths. And that's looking at the issue of child refugees and actually a direct challenge through short film, not just to the government, but to all of us, as to the way that child refugees have been represented in the media. I'll just quickly talk about my own work, because you might be wondering why me and why I'm standing here. But certainly what I try to do is, one of the countries that I specialise in, it's a very long story, but I've been working on and off in Nepal for about 15 years. I do something called participatory video, which is where I try and engage people, teach them the tools to make their own film so that they have a real true voice coming through the film, and not a director's voice like myself as an outsider, and support them to go through the whole process of setting the agenda of the film, filming each other and having a say in the final edit and where it's distributed. So the social impact of those films can happen on both a long-term level and a short-term level. For example, they may go towards building an understanding between different groups and communities in Nepal, or they may be direct action films which are calling for a change in certain legislations or a change in aspects of society. Not dictated by me, I have to add, but coming from people in Nepal themselves. So I've labelled this slide "may have" because obviously social change and social action doesn't happen like as a result of one thing, but it depends on the environment and what's happening around us at the time, the sort of political momentum that's building. My argument is here that films can play a part in building that momentum. They can play a part in informing, educating, and inspiring people towards change. So a few examples would be, I made a film about a girl who lives as a living goddess. It's a very beautiful tradition, Kumari, the living goddess of Nepal, but it's fraught with huge ethical issues around child rights and girls' rights in particular. I made it in 2005. It was part of a kind of shift in awareness and attitudes towards this tradition, which had been very protected. And in fact, it resulted, not from the film, but from this movement in change in law. So the Supreme Court changed the legislation around how this tradition is carried out, and the girls were given more freedom and rights to education. Other things like Gadamai Festival in Nepal, every 5 years sees a mass slaughter of animals, hundreds of thousands of them over a couple of days. There's a huge campaign that was launched to stop this. We made a film in 2010, and last year it was banned. 2010 film Through Our Eyes with child soldiers who were involved in the Maoist Civil War, post-conflict peace and resolution movements need to foster kind of understanding about why children went away to war, because when they returned to their communities, they faced a lot of discrimination and a lot of issues within the family. So this was part of a process in trying to foster understanding and build bridges. And my current film that I'm working on, which I'm going to have to rush off and edit today, is about girls living on the streets of Kathmandu. And there's currently a shift in government law towards the rights of street children. And this was commissioned particularly to contribute to that debate. So, you know, in my experience, film can have an impact on social change. And this is where I'd sort of give out a call to all of you, because now film and social action and social change is really enhanced by the use of social media. And it's also about the fact that the tools of filmmaking have become much more democratized. It's not expensive anymore. It's not an elite kind of industry where only certain people can kind of gain access to the BBC or making films for Channel 4. We are all filmmakers. I mean, most of us have a mobile phone. Most of us are able to film something on a mobile phone. And we can make our own films. So the idea is that you get out there, All of those speakers that I saw this morning, I was just imagining each one of those would make an amazing film. They could be sent out on Twitter, on Facebook. I mean, it's an instant, accessible, visual, and powerful way of communicating ideas in a way that this is going to be shared, I'm sure, on the internet as well. So these films can ask for calls of action, whether to stop a behavioural change, a voting pattern, call to MP, join a demonstration, community action. There's lots and lots of resources out there on how to make a film, and you've got the equipment in your phone. So there's a list of links here, which I'm not going to go through, but they will be available on the website, and that's finding access to sort of how-tos, lots and lots of films that are very well known, very well known for creating a social impact on all kinds of levels, and yeah, just lots of links and resources on how to make your own. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Tasia. Very interesting call to action there. Something concrete could come out of all this, definitely. I'm now going to introduce Louis Smith, who works in the technology sector, but is an anthropologist and a social scientist at heart. He has researched early Bitcoin adopters, and he sees social and cultural considerations as key to designing technological change, of course. And he's going to talk on unconditional basic income for all.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the introduction. I'm going to talk a little bit about this idea of universal basic income. I'm going to talk about where the idea has come from, why it's back in vogue now, and what kind of obstacles maybe it faces. So what is it? What is an unconditional basic income? Essentially, it's a payment received every week or every month to every individual in a community from some kind of collective fund, usually the state, okay? And the idea is that this payment will be enough to cover the costs of your shelter, your food, your education, and your basic healthcare needs, okay? So essentially it's welfare. It's a kind of social safety net. But unlike welfare, you get it even when you work, so it's always there as a supplement. So any wages you earn become a supplement to your basic income. So it does a few things, right? And it's an idea that it takes a while to get your head around the different implications. The two ones I would draw attention to are that it changes your relationship with work, because suddenly work is more than a source of income. It's not more than a source of sustenance, because you have this guaranteed source of sustenance elsewhere. Work is something that you can engage and negotiate with in an empowered way. And it also changes your relationship with the state. So instead of the state being something with a transactional relationship where, you know, I promise I will look for work, and in exchange the state gives me job seeker's allowance, instead this is something that I'm a member of the state and thus have the right to claim the ability to live a dignified life as a result of that. So it's an old idea. It was first suggested in modern literature in 1795 by Thomas Paine, the American revolutionary. And its modern revival now is really around the 60s and 70s. And it's interesting in that it's an idea that has support on the left and on the right. And they're two quite different emphases, but they're ultimately complement each other. So the left-wing argument that came up in the 60s and 70s is that political liberty is meaningless if you're living in poverty, right? And that's why you get support from people like Martin Luther King and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and very much see basic income as a way of empowering people who otherwise end up in a conditional relationship, that and their right to life is contingent on whoever's making the payments. But on the right, you also get support because they see basic income as a way of clarifying the relationship between those who need support and the state, and essentially trying to remove the level of arbitrary rule that the state can govern with. Right? So you get support for basic income from people like Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek, who would be right-wing free market libertarians. And it's an idea that it doesn't just live on the fringes. So one of the lesser known facts about basic income is that in the early 70s, Nixon, the US president, proposed it, and it got as far as Congress, and it passed in Congress, and then it failed in the Senate. So it's an idea that is radical, but not completely implausible. Okay, so what do we know about it? We know that it lifts people out of poverty, right? That's by definition what it does. So we know that the benefits you get from basic income are all the ones you would expect from removing poverty in a community. So you get improved levels of education across the board, you get improved levels of health, especially mental health, you get improved social cohesion and so on. In experiments in the developing world, you get a really drastic increase in economic activity, right? So we saw this most recently in a study in Namibia, where you have a twofold economic stimulus. On the one hand, people have more money to invest in businesses, and on the other hand, the general population has increased spending power, so those businesses are more likely to thrive. That makes sense. In the rich world, it's a harder sell, because we already have welfare mechanisms in place, and you have to prove that it's better. So one of the most high-profile studies was in the 70s in Canada. It's a slight variation on basic income called MINCOM, minimum income. And they found that, right, it led to all these benefits, but it also led to slightly less work. People were working slightly less because they suddenly had this extra money. And that was used by there was a change in government, and that was used by the incoming government to kill the project. And then years later, as researchers went over those original, those Canadian studies, they said, well, okay, people worked less, but who worked less? And they found that the only two groups in the community that worked in a statistically significant less, fewer hours per week, were new mothers and teenagers. And so actually you get really good social outcomes, because at the moment our economy is extracting labor from people who could actually be, in a long term, would be benefiting far better from investing that time in raising their children or investing their time in being in full-time education. And the other big experiment I should mention is that in Alaska, they have the Alaska Permanent Fund, which is since 1982 has been paying roughly $1,000 to every resident of Alaska per year. Now, obviously, it's not a basic income. It's a fraction of that, but it gives a sense of the fact that having a unconditional payment to everyone in the state doesn't make the sky fall down, right? That this is something that people cognitively can get used to remarkably quickly once it comes in. So why are we talking about it now? Why is this something that's kind of coming back up on the agenda now in 2016 after a lull over the 80s, 90s, and noughties? One of the reasons is fear of robots, right? Fear of automation. And I work in the technology sector. I think the effect of automation on jobs is more nuanced than people say. I don't think we're going to have a jobless future. I think technology concentrates jobs rather than destroys them, and it changes the profile of the kind of work that's needed. But it's actually, in the States, there are a number of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who are driving this agenda themselves, because the sympathetic view is because they're so close to these automation technologies that they see the kind of effects that they expect it to have. Okay, so in what way are jobs changing? Well, you imagine Kodak used to have 100,000 or 140,000 employees. They were all relatively middle class, right? And there was good jobs for lots of people. Kodak went bankrupt. It wasn't able to compete with digital photography. And then if you take a company like Instagram, when it was sold to Facebook for $1 billion, it had only 13 employees. So you suddenly have a phenomenal concentration of jobs into a few small, very highly paid jobs working with the big technology infrastructure. That's one way jobs are changing. The other way jobs are changing is that more investment in terms of education is needed to get someone to the point where they can go out onto the market and get money for their time. So if you imagine now you've got situations in certain sectors where someone will need to go through secondary education, degree, master's, and an internship, and only then will they be reach the point of empowerment where they can actually insist on getting paid fully for whatever they're doing. There's a number of reasons why that's happening. One of them is that employers used to be happy to pay for training, and the reason they could pay for training was because it was on the understanding that you would stay with that employer for 20, 30, 40 years. That informal social contract between employees and employers has broken down, and so you need to create other kind of social systems that can accommodate that. And then the third big reason of why we're hearing more about it now is inequality. That inequality is on the increase. The share of wages as a percentage of the economy is in decline. The share of business profits as a percentage of the economy is on the increase. So that's the kind of the Thomas Piketty argument. But and maybe more one that's less academic would be if you see how we've seen it for decades or even centuries in Latin America, where high inequality leads to extreme politics. So you get swings from far left to far right because the level of disenfranchisement within the economy is too high. And that's potentially what we're seeing again now in Western Europe and the United States. So there's a reasonable center ground that understands the risks of allowing inequality to go too high, and there's attention looking at creative ways of avoiding some kind of systemic meltdown. So one of the most interesting supporters that's come out in the last 2 years, I believe, in Britain is the RSA, the Royal Society of Arts. So that's a very much an old institution since the Industrial Revolution that has always been preaching for very reasonable solutions, has generally been very pro-industry, and now they've come out as being basic income. Luckily, I don't have time to go into the criticisms of basic income, but I'll touch on them very quickly, just to say the top criticism, the top two is obviously that we can't afford it. You know, where does all this money come from? And the answer is, well, there are a number of ways you can answer that. It would probably involve a profound re-engineering of the tax system. RSA has a proposal that's relatively unintrusive. And the second criticism is that people won't work. That if you give them money, they stop working. I also think that's not true. I think people are always happy to take more money if it's there to be had. The criticisms I think that are more valid but are sort of more nuanced, one is that you have a decision to make around sort of who gets it and how that interacts with immigration policies. So you've actually got quite a dilemma there. The second is that the basic income has the potential to weaken the rest of the welfare state. And the third is that it creates a scenario where people could opt out of society in a manner that isn't currently possible, unless you're rich. But that's it. I don't have any calls to action, so other than to go look this up if this is something you're interested in, and keep an eye out for it, because I think it's something we're going to hear more of as go on. Thanks.
Thank you. So we've had quite a range. We've had Natasha talking about the reverence for life. Tessa has encouraged us to make our own films to get social change. And Louis has given us a picture of the concentration of jobs rather than technology destroying them. Now, we're running very short of time, so I'm going to take the questions again in a group of three. So can I see who has the first question? Oh, come on, don't all put your hand up, put together. Well, let's take this one here.
Hi, I'm Etuga. I'm interested in the universal basic income, all of a sudden. what do you think the constraints on sustainability of universal basic income is? It seems to me that there's a lot of change required. Well, it will lead to a lot of change. A lot of change is required. And it's by no means easy to see that the results of small experiments can be extended to to a large society.
Let's have Alex there next. You had your, well, and then you, after him.
Hi, also on the base universal income, you pointed to the possibility of it being organised with the collective being at other levels than the state, and I wonder if there's any experience or ideas about running a system like that on a smaller scale, such as broccoli, for example.
Yeah, it's another question for you, Louis. I think one of the attractions of it is that it's less bureaucratic, but people's needs are obviously very different, and some people need a lot more support than others, and that changes at very different times of their lives. So I'm guessing that you see this as a system that sits alongside a welfare system. I wondered what, if you could say a little bit more about that.
Thank you. Can you answer that quickly?
Yeah, okay. Is this mic on? So in terms of sustainability, yeah, it's certainly different. People's behaviour changes when they know something is permanent as distinct from short-term and just for a study. I don't think the size of the economy should matter. But that's why, a few of the Nordics are doing more in-depth research into how people interact with this kind of thing. So Finland is doing some research to see that. In broader terms, is something like the sustainable, I think yes, as long as it's built into the tax system as distinct from the monetary system. So one of the red herrings you hear is that we can print money and give it out to people to allow them to survive. I don't think that's a sustainable solution. So a few different angles on that. In terms of non-state basic income, well, the problem here is that the state has a monopoly on the ability to force people to pay taxes. And so that's what retains the value of the money and manages things like inflation. I think you can do it at a community level as a political or almost artistic project. I don't think you could do it at a community level to such an extent that people could then live off it. But there are a few different projects. So I'm from the kind of, I work in a sector called on blockchain technology. So it's a set of technologies around distributed systems. And there are projects out there trying to do what you've described, to try to put something like this into action, but without state enforcement. I don't think it's a long term. I don't think it'll get there, but anyway. In terms of the role of the welfare state, yeah, I think people overstate the benefits of getting rid of all the kind of welfare bureaucracy, and they underestimate the value that brings to people in vulnerable situations. This is a shift that's happening anyway, where welfare bodies are pushing decision making onto users themselves, and the impression is I get that in most cases that's received positively. But yeah, absolutely, there's definitely, especially when you're into things like disability, there'll be a huge role for the state to continue to look out for people who no one else is looking out for.
Thank you. I'm going to allow us to overrun by a few minutes, only a few minutes. Are there any other questions? Perhaps from the back, and perhaps not necessarily on basic income. Anyone else at the back? You've already had a question, John. No one else at the back. Right, that man over there, please. And who else was interested with a question elsewhere? Okay, well, let me have you first, and then Richard.
Hello, this is a question for Natasha. I thought your talk was very inspiring, so thank you very much for that. I just wondered if you could talk about how we should have respect for all people, because that sits sort of uneasily, the idea of respecting bigots or child abusers, that kind of thing. Do you think we should respect those people? And if so, how do we go about doing it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Is this on? And then the next one will be Richard. Oh. And who was it? Let me, at the back, are there any third questions from someone who hasn't asked before? And one more question. Richard, you did have a question, did you?
Yeah.
Well, come on.
All right, so it was a session for Tessia, which was just about, I wondered, like, with using film as social action, and especially in somewhere like Nepal, whether you could comment on the problems you might face with, sort of, when governments and so on, or whether you experience any problems with being, shall we say, censored, and issues where it conflicts with a prevailing sort of regime.
Right, the third one, this man, you haven't had a question before, so I'm going to give you a chance.
Right, it's probably aimed at Tassia, which is about when Kathy Came Home came out. We all watched it because there were only two TV channels. Now there's a plethora of ways of watching TV or watching video. But it also applies across the panel. How do you sell your ideas in the, you know, how do you get across what are all interesting ideas? It's quite a challenge in this world where there's a million ways to sell your idea.
Thank you. I'll ask Natasha to go first, respect for all people.
Thank you. So I understand exactly what you're saying. It's really challenging. And, I get really angry about things as well when there's, certain decisions that are made politically and so on when people are suffering or disadvantaged because of it. That's why we have this practice, is to really... to really cultivate that respect. And I think the thing is, when we start labeling people, or this person, I can't respect them because they do this, or this person, or it's continuing that culture of difference, of judging that person, of, you know, and when we actually look at it in the fundamental sense that, okay, this person's in this place, they believe that what they're doing is right, or maybe they don't. Maybe they're really coming from a place where they feel they need to exert this power over someone. But that's actually something that we can have compassion for. It doesn't mean just sitting around and going, oh, positive thinking, and it will be great, and we'll just say everyone's lovely. That's absolutely a misunderstanding, if that's what you get from what I'm saying, because it's actually cultivating that deep respect and acting on that. And it's being able to stand up when there's injustice and speak in a respectful way. I don't agree with the statement that, these terrorists here, we can't reason with them because they're crazy. That is a disrespect of them. And actually, they're human beings. They're coming from a particular situation that we actually really need to have understanding for. And it's building that understanding universally across all people that will actually change that into a more peaceful culture. So yeah, I agree, it's a challenge. And that's why, you know, we have a daily practice to kind of really cultivate it. Even in our daily life, like if there's someone who I find difficult to respect, say, at work, then this is my challenge to transform that. So we do it at all levels. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. Tessia has now got two questions to answer.
Okay, so first of all, it's in response to Philip, and it's about how do you go about creating films if there's repressive regimes maybe stopping you from doing that. I think lots of my stuff is usually made in collaboration with existing organisations. So obviously the message is... it can be restricted, but in terms of what can be, where it's going to be broadcast and what can be said in public broadcast. In Nepal, for example, the films that I make with an organisation that works with street children, they have their own TV station. So, but there's a whole kind of etiquette of not pissing off the government ministers related to that. So, yes, that's a really important point. But one of the key... issues I faced was during the state of emergency in 2001 to 2003. I spent a lot of time filming around issues to do with the Maoist guerrilla war that was going on there, and it was a very dangerous situation, especially for journalists. And we had to employ all sorts of tactics to film. We had to pretend, I mean, we often pretended to be something that we weren't, like filming educational films about schools when really we were talking to school children about their experiences of war, and stuffing tapes, as it were, was then down our knickers and stuff like that, because we were often being stopped at checkpoints. So, there were huge difficulties, in fact, during that time. So that is an issue, for sure. In terms of your question, about, you know, is there room for so much? I mean, democratization of means of access to producing media doesn't necessarily mean quality, which is, you know, an issue I wanted to kind of push on. That is that, you know, while we have the means to make films, we need to still know how to tell stories and tell them well visually. But there is a huge debate at the moment. Is TV and the nature of mass audience and collective experience in watching television, is it dead with the rise of online broadcast or YouTube and so on? And research has suggested that no, not yet. Although we may not watch it in the same way as we might have done in the 50s, all huddled around the neighbour's TV and sharing that experience, people still do tune into mainstream TV, and so you will reach a mass audience in that sense. And then mainstream TV will be accompanied by skills, people at the top of their game, and budgets. However, there's a kind of revolution in what's being broadcast online, and I think that's absolutely key, in that different people's voices are being heard, different perspectives are being heard, and that people are getting access to tell really, really important stories that may not be shown on television because they're not commercial enough or they won't attract mass audience. So the way people are consuming these kind of films and, as a result, acting on them is changing. We're looking at individual audience. So one person searching out, actively searching out a film about a certain issue is different to somebody passively receiving it. Films spreading on social media, very important. That's another way of getting stuff out. In answer to the question, is there enough room? Probably yes. If people are selecting what they view with some discernment, then probably yes. I think there is enough room for everybody. And it will kind of naturally filter out the stuff that's probably not worth watching anyway.
Thank you very much. Well, this has been an interesting, if truncated, section, and we're going to end now. I do hope that in the break you will talk to the speakers. All the speakers have yellow badges, so you can go up, and that means that reminds you what their name is and also what they were talking about, and you can go and discuss with them, which I hope you will with all three of our speakers, since we haven't got more time for questions.